Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on air. On tonight's program, can your job give you cancer?
Even though people may think that this is something that disappeared in the United States a long time ago, people continue to be exposed to asbestos.
Plus, did President Warren G. Harding's choice of physician cost him his life?
He had some severe heart problems late in his status as president, and I think much of it was unrecognized at the time.
And a look at some cutting-edge research into the human cytomegalovirus.
In my age, about 10% of our immune system is dedicated to make it stay asleep. By the time you reach about 80% of our immunology or immune cells are dedicated to controlling this virus.
Our checkup from the neck up and a selection from our healing muse, and that's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we take a historical journey and discover the circumstances surrounding the death of President Warren G. Harding. Plus, we'll hear about some cutting-edge research into human cytomegalovirus. But first, can your job give you cancer? It's well known that many workplaces may harbor carcinogens, and long-term exposure might place you at risk for developing cancer. But can your job actually give you cancer? Well, here with some answers is our Dr. Michael Lax. He is a professor in the Department of Family Medicine and the medical director of the Occupational Health Clinical Center at Upstate Medical University. And Dr. Gerald Abraham, he's a professor of pathology and the director of environmental and occupational pathology at Upstate Medical University. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate your being here. So, Dr. Lax, let me start with you. So your job can actually give you cancer? Tell us about that.
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of things that people are exposed to in the workplace, and it's known that a number of them can are linked to increased risk of cancer, and there's a lot of other substances where it's possible or probable that there's a link, but there's just not enough evidence to make it definitive.
Do we know what percentage at this point of work-related, you know, cancer is work-related?
Yeah, people have been arguing about that since the early 80s.
I'm sure.
Debating that on a lot of levels. But so there's a number of studies that were done. The estimates range from lows around 4% to highs more around 10 or 12%. But the big three cancers that are known in the United States to be related to work are lung cancer, maybe as much as 25%, bladder cancer, and mesothelioma, which is asbestos-related.
So when we talk about those three, give us an example of how and where you might contract those things. What kinds of occupations would lead you to any of those three?
Yeah, well, in terms of lung cancer, it sort of intuitively makes sense that lung cancer might be one of the cancers most at risk for people who are working, because a lot of materials are inhaled and they're deposited directly onto the lung tissue, so they have a chance to react with it. So, asbestos is probably the best known and the most common sort of carcinogen that people continue to be exposed to, even though people may think that this is something that disappeared in the United States a long time ago. People continue to be exposed to asbestos.
Now, why is that, though? Because I understand that there's all these asbestos containment programs where if you find there's asbestos in a building, you kind of stay away or you do things to mitigate exposure.
Well, I think it's a couple things. I mean, one thing is that people get exposed unknowingly, so that, for example, they don't expect it. So they go into a building, for example, say you're a telephone worker or a computer person, you're running wires into a commercial building that's kind of old, and there's asbestos in the spaces where they're running those wires in. They're getting exposed that way, so it's kind of unexpected. On the other hand, there are people who are doing asbestos directly. They know they're working with asbestos abatement, and they're just not doing the job correctly. I mean, here in Syracuse a few years ago, there was a father and son team that were convicted of and sent to prison for 20 years for running an asbestos abatement company that was basically exposing all their workers and then everybody who came into the building afterward to to the bad job that they were doing.
So that's horrible. Yeah. So you said there were two other types of diseases also. You mentioned bladder cancer and then mesothelioma.
Right.
So just briefly, where would your exposure be to bladder cancer?
Oh, bladder cancer has been known for quite a long time because, again, it's an organ that makes sort of intuitive sense as a target organ for a lot of different carcinogens because it's sort of like a reservoir for urine. In the urine, a lot of toxic materials are excreted that way, so they have a chance to sort of sit there and expose the bladder to it. And so, you know, dyes are a well-known one. One that we've dealt with recently is with coal tar pitch, which is found, for example, in aluminum smelters and other places.
And the last one, mesothelioma, that's also to do with asbestos exposure.
Mesothelioma is a rare cancer is linked to pretty much one particular exposure, which is asbestos, and really there's no other known exposure that causes it.
Dr. Abraham, why then is this so important in terms of understanding, you know, what cancers are work-related? What's the significance? I mean, it seems self-evident, but in your mind, what's the significance?
Well, it's really important. I wanted to pick up on a couple of things that you mentioned and that Dr. Lax mentioned. Also, it's really important because when an individual is diagnosed with cancer, then usually that diagnosis is made by the surgeon doing a biopsy and sending it to a pathologist, and then the pathologist is responsible for properly identifying and classifying that cancer. The pathologists also need to be sensitive that when they receive a biopsy, sometimes there's evidence in that biopsy besides the cancer. For example, if someone has a lung surgery for a cancer, there's a lung tissue involved as well in that surgery. And often it has clues that a person has had exposure to things like asbestos or other dusts and things like that, that a pathologist can identify. So it's really important for the pathologists to be aware of this and for the clinicians and the patients to say, well, is there any clue in there? What evidence is there of exposures I might not have remembered? And it also leads into the importance of the physicians collecting a very thorough history of occupational exposures and even residential exposures that person has had throughout their entire life, not just during the few weeks before their surgery. Sometimes you'll see in the medical charts under the little heading of occupation, it may say retired, and that's all it says about a person's occupation. So as physicians, we're generally doing a poor job of collecting occupational information unless the people see somebody like Dr. Lax, who takes a thorough occupational history. Now, the reason it's important to identify these things is not only for that person. Once you have the cancer, it's very unlikely that knowing that it's related to your occupation will affect how it's treated, but it's really important for the individual because they may be eligible for some compensation, and if it's work-related, the responsibility of different insurance plans comes into effect. If it's work-related, for example, it may be that they should have it covered by workers' compensation insurance rather than their regular medical insurance. And sometimes the medical regular insurers battle with workers' comp for who's responsible, trying to put the cost onto the other one. Also, if it's identified that a certain workplace can cause exposures that result in cancer, it's very important for the other workers at that place to be notified and to prevent further exposure. And the most far-ranging thing is if there's a new exposure that hasn't previously been recognized to be related to a cancer or any other disease, is that prevention of exposure by better regulation can follow from the proper identification. And as the other couple of things you mentioned earlier on, was that about long-term exposures resulting in cancers. And that's especially relevant to the disease that Dr. Lax and you talked about a minute ago, about mesothelioma, which is a rare cancer in the general population. Maybe one or two cases of this cancer per million people in the population per year will get this if they haven't had asbestos exposure that's recognized. Whereas in a heavily exposed asbestos workers, you may have 10 or more percent of the people followed for their lifetime that die of this disease. So anybody can do some calculations to see that's a great increase from one or two per million to 10% of the people.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Michael Lax and Dr. Gerald Abraham. And we're talking about workplace carcinogens. But so obviously, Dr. Abraham just elucidated very clearly why it's important to know where the cancer came from. I mean, even beyond the idea of helping the individual with insurance coverage, to know if we can actually mitigate a circumstance where they were working or put into place regulations that would make a difference. Why currently is it so difficult? What are the roadblocks to quantifying this kind of data?
Well, there's a lot of them. You know, I think the United States do a lot of recording of or documenting of exposures, in the sense that we're not really sure what people are exposed to in the workplace. When manufacturers or employers want to introduce a material into the workplace, they're not required to document that they're doing it or that there's a health problem related to it. And we really don't document people's health histories, or not health histories, but occupational histories during their course of their health evaluations. So we don't have there's no real easy mechanism to do the sorts of epidemiologic studies to really gather large groups of people where we know what they've been exposed to, how much they've been exposed to, for how long, all in a common place, so that you could actually do decent studies.
Is someone studying this currently, though? I mean, you always hear about OSHA, and there's so much emphasis on OSHA, the whole idea of occupational safety and health, the concept being that we're trying, at least, or at least maybe it's a name only, but we're trying to make an impact here.
Yeah, but the problem is huge, in the sense that you have something like 140,000 different substances that are in common use in industry, and about 2% of them have been tested for their carcinogenic potential. So really you have 98%, which we have really zero information on about that. So yes, people are certainly studying sorts of different kinds of occupational hazards, but the job is huge, and there's a lot of, I think, in terms of studies, you need money, you need financing and backing to do the sorts of studies. And I think most of that, the financing goes to sort of looking for things where there's a lot that's already known, as opposed to doing more what you might think of as exploratory work in areas where there's not a lot that's known.
But it's been estimated that we have between 24,000 and 60,000 deaths secondary to occupational exposure of some sort. It's not all cancer, am I correct?
No, it's cancer.
That's all cancer.
Right.
I mean, those are staggering numbers. To think that there isn't more of an effort being made is somewhat shocking.
Well, yeah, I think so. But, that's sort of the common lament of those of us who are in the field of occupational health, that worker health is something that takes second place or third place or fourth place in terms of national priorities and national attention. I mean, if you just look at it from a funding perspective, you look at OSHA and NIOSH, which are the sort of flip sides of a coin. OSHA regulates workplaces and sets standards. NIOSH, which is with the CDC affiliated organization, really does the research and or funds research that then provides the information for OSHA to make regulations. And the amount of funding they receive relative to other agencies involved in environmental safety and consumer safety and a bunch of other agencies, really very tiny. So worker health is, even though the exposures to workers are in most cases are orders of magnitude higher than what people experience in the environment, the amount of resources that go into studying it, looking at it, preventing it are really quite small.
So, I mean, what if you are a worker and you're listening to this out there? Two questions I have is, what do you recommend someone do in terms of either evaluating their particular workplace? Is there some way they can gather information in terms of their exposure? That's number one. And number two, what if you're diagnosed with a cancer, and does it affect your treatment in any way? Or let's say you can still continue to work in that environment. What should you be doing proactively to protect yourself?
Well, I guess there's two levels of prevention that we're talking about. There's primary prevention and there's secondary prevention. Secondary prevention is for somebody who's been exposed. Are there tests that can be done to actually predict or see if they have a propensity or possibly the cancer developing? And those opportunities are pretty limited. But low-dose CT scanning is one that shows some promise for lung cancer. On the other hand, I think the main emphasis should be on primary prevention, which is the reduction of and elimination of carcinogenic exposures in the workplace. And yes, workers have rights in terms of right to know what they work with. And there's now with the internet and things, there's a lot of opportunities for them to sort of figure that out a bit more. But the problem comes with, okay, once they figured it out, what can they do about it? And that's the more difficult question.
But the point is, they should be in some way trying to determine if their workplace is carcinogenic, and if it is, what they can be doing to protect themselves, obviously, because you don't want to end up with the cancer and then having to basically deal with all the sequelae of that.
That's right? Correct. If time allows, I could give you just one quick anecdote. Just this morning on my way to work, I drove past an area where they were doing some road construction. The people were using heavy equipment to tear up the blacktop asphalt paving, heating it up, grinding it up, and it was a very dusty operation. There were clouds of smoke coming out of the machines, and the operators of the machines were just sitting there in the smoke without any protection whatsoever. And the chemicals in asphalt include hydrocarbons and things like that that are known carcinogens, yet there are regulations, but they're not being enforced. So if the workers aren't informed, or their foreman says, well, that's too much trouble to provide adequate respiratory protection, there's a flaw, obviously, as Dr. Lax was talking about, in the funding for OSHA to do the inspections and regulations of these things, and in the employers supervising it for not paying attention to that. But ultimately, they're responsible.
So it continues to be a real issue, obviously, especially with the numbers you've quoted. Well, I want to thank you for both coming in and at least highlighting the importance of this kind of thing. And hopefully, if people are listening and are in an environment where they have some concerns about the amount of carcinogens they may be exposed to, that maybe they'll take some proactive efforts to protect themselves. Thanks so much again. My guests have been Dr. Michael Lax. He's the He is a professor in the Department of Family Medicine. He's also the medical director of the Occupational Health Clinical Center at Upstate Medical University. And Dr. Gerald Abraham, professor of pathology and director of environmental and occupational pathology at Upstate Medical University. Thanks again for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Next up, how a poor choice of physicians may have cost Warren G. Harding his life. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Warren Harding, the 29th President of the United States, died in office in 1923 at the age of 57 of what were called natural causes. While he was one of the least popular presidents in our history, perhaps one of his most fatal flaws may have been his choice of physicians. We'll hear with more on this as Dr. Harold Smullyan, emeritus professor of medicine, specializing in cardiology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Smullyan. Thanks for coming in. So you just wrote a paper drawn from historical sources describing the symptoms and the circumstances that may have led to Warren Harding's early demise. Tell us about it.
Well, Warren Harding was elected following the First World War, promising the country a period of normalcy. So he, in fact, did very little as a president and was, in some quarters, thought to be our worst president. But he had some severe heart problems late in his status as president. And I think much of it was unrecognized at the time. And I think had it been his medical care could have been improved.
What were the symptoms that he was, as you were doing your research, what led you to believe that he had heart problems?
Well, in retrospect, he had complained of chest pain, of shortness of breath, and his valet had stated that he had symptoms that are very typical of the shortness of breath of patients in congestive heart failure, that symptom being called orthopnea. So his valet gave a very good description of this symptom for him.
And what was that symptom?
Well, it's a shortness of breath that's aggravated by lying down. So he had to sleep sitting up, and this was noticed by his valet and reported on.
So you were really kind of digging around into all of these kind of assorted sources and trying to kind of glean together or garner together facts that would lead you to that diagnosis, so to speak.
That's correct.
So what actually caused his death, do you think?
Well, it's a bit speculative, but just before he died, perhaps an hour or so before, he had a period of perhaps unconsciousness that lasted only for seconds. And then he claimed to feel better again, and then shortly after that, he had a sudden death. The idea that he died relatively suddenly suggested that it was a cardiac death rather than a death from a stroke, which was what it was called at the time. So I think the evidence is fairly good that this was a death from probably a cardiac arrhythmia, an abnormal rhythm of the heart.
And somewhere in your writings, I noticed that there was some speculation that he had a rapid heartbeat, like atrial fibrillation, which was also, was that chronic for him, do you think, or had just recently occurred prior to his death?
It's unclear when it actually began, but while he was on this voyage of understanding that he took to Alaska, which lasted quite a long time.
So this was a long trip he took to go to Alaska and then ended up in San Francisco where he died.
That's right. He was coming back to Washington on his after visiting Alaska. And it was somewhere during that time where it was noticed that his heart rate was very fast.
So what you allude to this throughout your paper. How do you think his choice of an official presidential physician may have played a role in this?
Well, who he chose is explicable. His parents were both homeopathic physicians, and he chose a homeopathic physician while he was still working in Ohio, where he came from.
And he was an editor of a paper before he ran for president, right?
He actually owned the paper. Mm-hmm. And this physician was very helpful to his wife, Florence, and she was very reluctant to move to Washington when he became president without the services of Dr. Sawyer, her physician.
Can you define for the general public when we say a homeopathic physician? How is that? What's the distinction there?
Well, homeopathy hasn't been taught in the United States for a long time. It was based on the use of extremely small doses of medications to correct abnormalities in the patients, and these small doses are no longer believed to be effective.
So it was a recognized means of education for a physician, but it was a particular field?
It was recognized for a time, but by the time he became sick in 1923, it was clearly on the decline, there being only two other homeopathic medical schools left in the United States.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on air. I'm Linda Cohen here with cardiologist Dr. Harold Simoleon. We're talking about the untimely death of the 29th president of the United States, Warren G. Harding, and a paper that Dr. Simoleon has written trying to elucidate and investigate what the causes were that led to his untimely death. So you mentioned his wife, Florence, and she was very tied to this physician and apparently had also some medical kidney problems of which he was helpful with, this homeopathic physician. But she was very influential in his life. It sounds like even maybe a little bit too much so, or a little bit too bossy, for want of a better term.
She promised when he was a senator to make him president of the United States. And one gets the sense from reading the material about her that she was an overbearing person and that he was quite willing to accept her advice, feeling inadequate to the job.
To the job of being president.
Exactly.
I think throughout, there were a lot of indications of that throughout, that he really, how did I get here? What am I doing here as president? But nevertheless, he did accept her advice with regard to this position. Do you feel that, obviously, that choice may have rendered him more vulnerable to his problems? Was it that his physician was unable to or unwilling to recognize some of these symptoms?
I doubt if he was unwilling, but I think he was unable, not well enough trained, familiar with the modern changes that had gone on in medicine during the preceding few years. So I think he was unable to really understand what was going on with the president and attributed his illness to food poisoning, which was clearly not the case.
The final illness, the specific illness. Yes. So what was the state of diagnostics back then? I mean, do you think, well, first, what was the state of diagnostics in terms of cardiac difficulties? But then do you think if he had been diagnosed correctly, that anything could have changed?
Well, I'll answer your second question first.
Sure.
Most of the errors that were made or the deficiencies that were apparent in his medical care were those in diagnosis. Had the correct diagnosis been made, there might have been some changes in his therapy that would have prolonged his life. But I think the major errors were diagnostic rather than therapeutic, because there wasn't really much available.
So there really, you did mention earlier that there were changes in medicine back then. What were the changes that might have played a role?
Well, for example, electrocardiography was widely used at that time. It seemed clear from reviewing what was available that his physicians didn't understand how to use that. It was recommended that he have one when he was near death, but his wife wouldn't permit him to be moved to the hospital since the electrocardiogram machine wasn't transportable.
So they didn't have portable EKG machines, which currently now obviously is the state of the art.
There were some, but apparently there weren't any at Stanford where his consultants were in practice.
So basically, it sounds like if he had had better medical care all along, do you think that the circumstances, the outcome might have changed?
I think his life could have been prolonged. I think the final outcome would have eventually been the same.
Mm-hmm. But he was quite young, or I guess for that era, was 57 considered quite young?
I consider it quite young.
We all do today, but I'm wondering back then.
I think that probably he could have expected to live somewhat longer had they been able to treat him better.
So was he also overweight? Did he suffer from some degree of obesity as well?
Yes, he was obese, and even more important, he had high blood pressure and had it for many years. There was really no effective therapy of high blood pressure at that time, but his heart failure could have been better treated with some medications that were available.
Like diuretics of that
age? Diuretics really didn't come into popular use until after he was dead. But digitalis was available, and he did get a dose or two of digitalis just before he died. I think more use of that, more rest, keeping him less active than he had been forced to be would have been useful.
And as you mentioned, he was on this voyage to Alaska, which from my reading was his wife's idea, because she had always wanted to see Alaska, and they created this so-called voyage of understanding, which apparently was quite strenuous, and this was just prior to his death.
That's correct. Alaska at that time was not a state. It was still a territory, and he was the first president to visit it. So I think it had some symbolic importance, and he did make numerous stops along the seacoast where his ship took them and made many, many speeches on the way there and on the way home.
Is it possible, I mean, when do you surmise that that degree of exertion could have also played a role?
I think so.
And also, it's funny. So what finally killed him in your mind? What finally killed him?
I think an arrhythmia of the heart.
Okay.
And I think he probably had coronary heart disease, which is very common in people with high blood pressure and obesity.
Following his death, I don't want to run out of time. We only have a little bit of time left. But there were all these scandals that came out, both in terms of his own administration, but also his personal life. Do you think that those could have been playing a role or weighing heavily on him in terms of stress as well?
Well, I'm sure that stress plays an important role in everybody who becomes ill, whether it's from mental illness or otherwise. And he had a lot of stress from the revelations that he had been unfaithful to his wife, and that the major scandals of his administration, particularly the Teapot Dome scandal, weighed heavily on his mind.
So why do you do this kind of work in the little bit of time we have left? What draws you to do this kind of medical detective work?
I retired from active patient care about a year ago. But I still enjoy coming to the office every day, and this gives me an opportunity to do some productive work, not involving the care of patients, but it is fun for me and I hope will entertaining for people who read it.
Absolutely, and you're shedding light on the history of medical science and its advancements in doing so. So I want to thank you so much for coming in and joining me. My guest has been Dr. Harold Smullyan. He's Emeritus Professor of Medicine, specializing in cardiology at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. Brush back drive-bys, or if dog brain, then... Well, folks, after a gorgeous sunrise bike ride on the Erie Canal Trail the other day, I was heading home. Had flipped on my tail light flashing red. Watch out for me, red, watch out for me. Huffing up a hill, the road narrowing 50 feet from a stop sign where I'd be turning right. I look behind, see a car a ways back, and make that weird left arm raised, bent 90 degrees at the elbow, right turn signal. I'm moving off the disappearing shoulder into the lane. 20 feet from the stop, the car roars by, a windy, hair-raising hair from my elbow. Scares the bike shorts off me, if you can imagine that. You may not want to. Now, having had several such close encounters of this unkind kind, and knowing the research shows that what helps us to be who we want to be in tough spots is having an if this happens, then I'll do that plan, I've rehearsed just what to say instead of shouting expletives, thinking I would educate the person on how scary brushback drive-bys are for us pedal pushers. So he stopped, and I stopped beside him and look in. A well-dressed guy in a spiffy car doesn't look threatening, and he's not on his cell phone. Surprise. I tap on the window. He rolls it down, and I say, going by that close and fast is scary for us ride bikers. He, mad dog, lunges. Why don't you stay on the shoulder, you? Referring to anatomy possibly visible if I were missing my bike shorts. Good intentions explode. My dog brain growls, because there's glass, and expletive deleted, over there! He spits more curses, which I brilliantly echo, toothy spitty growl for growl, and off we wheel. Wow. With the best of conscious intentions and a plan. Amazing how automatic dog brain is when threat comes close, huh? Why didn't the plan work? Well, it was a plan for a reasonable me and him, made with a cool brain. And at that moment, my life had just been threatened. My heart was pounding and my brain was hot. And I wasn't paying enough attention to my heart-pounding dog brain. What might work better next time? No dog brain speed and power. Plan with a cool brain, knowing our hot brain when neck hairs bristle, blood boils, and saliva drips. New plan. No dog brain is automatic in hot and close, and has no interest in education. Don't go in close. Pull back and away on my own leash. Forget educating a hot dog brain. We might get eaten. Educating over the radio is close enough. I'm Dr. Rich, Woof Woof O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Next, the search for a cure to that ubiquitous villain, human cytomegalovirus. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen with your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of October 13th. Give a nod to nature. Nature's stress-relieving effects have been praised and practiced for thousands of years. Recent studies have confirmed this simple notion. People recover faster from stressful and painful incidents when exposed to natural environments. And those who can access nearby nature have been found to be healthier and more satisfied in their home, job, and life in general. This week, fit in at least one 10 to 15 minute session with nature. Whether it be taking a hike in the woods, sitting outside, and listening to the birds and insects, or reflecting upon a body of water, take time to reacquaint yourself with nature's restorative power. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Human cytomegalovirus is found throughout the world and in all socioeconomic groups, and it infects between 60 and 70% of adults in industrialized countries and almost 100% in emerging countries. While in most healthy adults, it's asymptomatic. It is not benign, however, and it can contribute to many more severe disease states. We'll hear with more on this as Dr. Gary Chan. He's assistant professor of microbiology and immunology at Upstate Medical University, and he's just received a sizable grant to continue his studies in human cytomegalovirus, or HCMV. Welcome, Dr. Chan. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So you've just gotten a great deal of money, a sizable amount of money, to continue your work in HCMV. Tell me about that.
We just received a grant from NIH, or the National Institute of Health, which is our major funding agency. And they gave me about $500,000 so far to continue my studies.
$500,000.
Yeah.
I would say that's sizable. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely agree.
So they must think you're on to something.
Yeah. You know, and they're really, times are tough right now. They're trying to support young people like me. Right, in our future endeavors. So,
yeah, but because times are tough, one would think they would not be supporting someone who was, you know, a slacker.
Yeah,
obviously,
that's obviously true.
You're onto something. So help us understand what you're trying to do. What, first of all, maybe help us understand a little bit more about human cytomegalovirus. What is it?
Oh, CMV is it's a herpes virus, right? It's found in all of us. Like most of us have heard about herpes simplex virus. It infects us, and it goes essentially dormant inside of us.
So people, for example, if they get a cold sore or something like that, is that a sign of it?
Very, very similar, right. HSV, or simplex virus, you know, resides in our body in our neurons, which gives us a cold sore. CMV resides in the bone marrow of our body, right? And so it lies dormant in our bone marrow. And when it reactivates, it can cause a lot of diseases, right?
So let me get this straight. And as I said in the beginning, between 60 and 70% of people in industrialized countries have it sitting in their bones, so to speak, sleeping, as you say, dormant?
Yeah, it's sleeping, essentially. And every once in a while, it'll wake back up, is what happens.
And what happens when it wakes back up?
Usually our body controls it, right? So, well, an interesting fact about CMV is about, you know, at my age, about 10% of our immune system is dedicated to make it stay asleep. And then about, by the time you reach about 80, about 80% of our immunology or immune cells are dedicated to controlling this virus. So it takes a lot of effort, right, for us to control it, because it can cause a lot of diseases if we don't control it.
Why is that? Tell us, what does it do?
It's a unique virus. You know, what we study is we study how this virus spreads around the body. And as part of its ability to spread around the body, it utilizes monocytes, which are essentially cells that are designed to normally protect us, right? It actually hijacks them.
And so it hitches a ride.
Right. Usually the monocyte acts like a Trojan horse, right? So it hides in these Trojan horses and gets around the body. So it's actually using our own immune cells against us. And then what happens is it's most viruses tend to want to stop inflammation. You know, everyone knows chronic inflammation is bad for you. And so what happens with this virus, it actually enhances inflammation in us because it actually uses it to replicate or to grow in our bodies.
Oh, that's very interesting. So let me see if I can understand what you're saying is the virus actually uses it, creates inflammation or uses inflammation.
Right.
To maintain its own life, so to speak, to survive.
Right, exactly. Whereas inflammation usually takes is usually against antiviral, right? CMV uses it actually and manipulates it.
Wow.
Right, and controls it.
This sounds like a very nefarious virus.
It is.
Evil virus.
Yeah. The thing about these viruses, they're interesting. It's herpes viruses. They evolved with us, right? They aren't.
They have evolved with us.
Yeah, okay. They aren't new viruses. They track these viruses to the dawn of dinosaurs, and they were here when we were here. And so we've co-evolved with them for a long, long time.
But obviously they haven't taken over.
No.
Otherwise we wouldn't still be here.
Right, no. And their goal isn't to take over. Their goal is just to survive with us.
But you mentioned a myriad of diseases that they could be responsible for.
Right.
Help us understand what those are.
So, in terms of symptoms of people with a full immune complement in their bodies, usually it doesn't do much. But what they have found is that it is linked to heart disease, arteriosclerosis, inflammatory bowel disease. And most interesting, about 5 years ago, they found it in 100% of glioblastomas. So it's found in all brain tumors, essentially what it is. And the interesting thing about it, I don't think it's a cause of brain tumors, but it's definitely part of the cause, or it wouldn't be there. And there are now new treatments out there. They're giving antivirals to glioblastoma patients, and they are extending their lifespan.
Wow. Right. So it's playing a role.
It's playing a role.
In many diseases, and not just in the people who are immunosuppressed.
Yeah.
Because obviously where they have a poor immune system, they're going to be more at risk for these for the virus to spread.
Right, right. And so in terms the biggest problem for this virus is that it causes a lot of disease in the immunosuppressed people, right? As I mentioned before,
HIV, AIDS patients, things like that.
Right.
Or cancer, people on cancer therapy.
Right, or transplants, or especially congenital infection. That's probably the most famous disease the CMV causes are congenital diseases. Although there's a real lack of awareness about CMV and congenital disease.
Give me an example of a congenital disease that it's a part of.
CMV is actually the most common or the most common infection, congenital infection in the world. And it actually, in fact, is the most common cause of long-term disabilities in children. And so many of the children are blind, deaf, stillborn. Many of them have neurological,
So they're born with the CMV in their bodies, and why does it wreak havoc in their particular bodies?
Because it causes massive inflammation, right? And so it really wreaks havoc actually during the development. So when they get infected in utero or during the pregnancy.
Well, tell us, first of all, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on air. I'm Linda Cohen here with microbiologist Dr. Gary Chan. We're talking about human cytomegalovirus and his efforts to better understand it. Tell me what you're trying to do in your study.
All right. So in terms of what NIH is funding me for, is what we're interested in is, I think I mentioned before that the CMV uses monocytes as a Trojan horse. And what we're trying to understand is how CMV manipulates the monocyte cell biology to allow it to act as a Trojan horse. Because normally it is designed to get rid of viruses, monocytes.
So it hijacks, as you said.
Right, right. And the interesting fact about monocytes is that typically they have a very short lifespan, right? We don't want long-lived monocytes. It'll wreak havoc on our bodies. But they go out, they probe, right? And they probe our body, see if there's an infection, and then go after that. If not, they die quickly, right? And CMV is able to reprogram the monocyte and allow them to have a long lifespan, which is not good for our bodies, right? But it is able to extend their lifespan and allow them to really act as a Trojan horse, right? And deliver the virus to different parts of the body.
So you're going to try to understand how it is that the CMV can make the monocytes do this.
Right, right. Basically how it causes them to survive.
And this is all done in the laboratory. Do you use animal models at all?
The thing about CMV that makes it somewhat difficult to study is that there's high species specificity. So in other words, human cytomegalovirus cannot infect any animals. And mouse CMV cannot infect humans. And in fact, human cell megaphytes can't even infect monkeys or primates.
So is CMV, the cytomegalovirus, existing, obviously, in all of these different species? Yeah. Is it really pretty much pandemic? I mean, is it everywhere?
Yeah, it's everywhere.
But it's species specific.
Right. And so it can't cross species. And so
how does that make it difficult for you? So you really would have to study the human in living tissue?
Right. And so what we usually do is we isolate monocytes from humans, right? Or from my grad students, essentially.
How do you do that?
So
it sounds kind of scary.
We draw blood, right? After we draw blood, we isolate the monocytes and then we infect them, right? Sometimes we can get naturally infected monocytes from transplant patients, right? Where it's a big problem. But usually we take it, we study it, we infect them, and then we try to study how, in fact, CMV is promoting the survival of these cells.
So you're basically looking at blood, and you're looking at the CMV in vitro. Is that how?
In vitro. Yeah. It's all in tissue culture, right? Mm-hmm. It's the only way we can do it right now.
Mm-hmm.
Upstate is in a unique position in that they have a pretty unique humanized mouse model system or facility. And so hopefully, maybe in the future, we'll go along that path and that we'll try to humanize a mouse and try to study.
Humanize a mouse. That's a very interesting concept. I'm trying to like envision it. So will it look like Mickey?
No. So essentially, we give it a human immune system.
Right.
I mean, there's lots of problems to that, but it's the best we've got right now.
Yeah.
Right. And so maybe in the future we can do that and try to study in vivo.
I do know that some other researchers we've spoken to are using mouse models to study different aspects of cancer, for example, because I guess they can, something about the mouse is in some way close to the human in some of its biologic responses. But in this case, obviously, the CMV is not translatable.
The CMV, human cell megaphytes cannot affect any of the mouse monocytes.
So how did you get interested in studying HCMV?
Honestly, I kind of fell into it. I always had an interest in virology. You know, fortunately, my father back in the day had a heart attack, which gave him a blood transfusion, right, in which he ended up with hepatitis. And that kind of led to my interest in viruses. And at that point, I went to grad school. You know, I tried to study some different viruses. And this one I just kind of latched onto. Right? I found it really interesting in that it co-evolved with us. Right. And for that reason, you know, it was a really complex interaction between it and the human host, right, which I was interested in. I actually studied in during pregnancy, was my graduate school days, and I've just stuck with this ever since. And 15 years later, here I am.
Wow. Well, it sounds like you're on some track here. It sounds like on a good track. What do you how do you foresee what's going to happen as a result of this study? Do you see this as a step in future studies?
Yeah. So what we're trying to do is understand really how CMV uniquely regulates monocyte cell biology, and from understanding how there's this unique regulation, we can target those unique interactions with antiviral drugs. And that's what my lab is doing actually right now, is using novel antivirals to target this, the unique biology that CMV is changing in the monocyte.
So the basic concept here underlying all of this does have some clinical application.
Yeah.
I mean, you're looking to eventually develop antivirals to affect, or would it basically eliminate CMV from the body?
Right. Well, I don't think we can ever do that.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's co-evolved with us. But at the same time, in transplant patients is where we can really help, because we can predict these infections.
Right? And perhaps control them. Well, it's very, very interesting work. And obviously, the NIH thinks it's very valuable work. So I want to thank you so much for coming in and sharing it with us. I hope you'll come back maybe when you have some things to report in your work.
Absolutely.
And tell us how it's going. That would be wonderful. My guest has been Dr. Gary Chan. He's assistant professor of microbiology and immunology at Upstate Medical University. Once again, thanks for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. As the school year gets underway, and parents no doubt are feeling the stress of readying the children for the school bus, or chauffeuring the children to practices or games, and supervising their homework, and always, always worrying about the children, I thought it might prove beneficial to read Maine poet Jan Bailey's Raising the Sleeping Dead, her tribute and elegy to empty nest syndrome. At long last, she's boiled herself down to salads and oatmeal, this woman of nine lives, no longer the genie of the kitchen, instant works of culinary art while snipping bits of fish sticks for toddlers, while nudging with her toe spilled pellets of Purina. Mostly alone and somewhat at a loss, she marvels at the time she spent feeding every sort of mouth, babies, of course, and husbands, but also goldfish, cats, gerbils, and a great horned toad, not to mention the weekly sousing of prayer plants and philodendrons. Now, at 60, her children grown, her husband on a planet all his own, she sticks to her simplicities, whole days slipping by in silence. She eats little, smokes an occasional secret cigarette, sips her sundown wine. Letters shrink to emails, cotton to Tencel. Her garden is a starving rhododendron. And she would like to tell you that she likes it. The dog mellowed out to melancholy, the dishes down to two. But often when she's snipping lettuce, brewing comfrey tea, how sweet it would be to have the screen door slam and somebody scream, "Mama," loud enough to raise the sleeping dead.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we journey into the laboratories of Upstate Medical University to discover several distinguished researchers and examine their cutting-edge research in breast cancer. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.